Yo, what's cracking? This your homeboy Ice Cube, and you tuned in to Everything Snowboarding and More podcast. You know what it is, baby.
Hey, everybody, this is Mike. Welcome back to the Everything Snowboarding and More podcast. This is episode number 47. This week's special guest is Bob Carlson. Bob Carlson is one of the co-founders of Arbor Snowboards. Arbor has been making these incredibly sustainable wooden snowboards for the last 25 years based in Venice Beach, California. This week's podcast is being sponsored by Snow King Mountain Resort. Snow King Mountain Resort is an often overlooked, really, really fun ski hill right in downtown Jackson, Wyoming. They opened a new gondola this year. They've got a new lift on the backside. Very, very steep mountain. If you really enjoy going fall line, I highly recommend checking out Snow King Mountain. And not just for steep skiing, they've got some beginner terrain up top, some new magic carpet, and all sorts of fun stuff. So the next time you find yourself in Jackson, maybe take a day away from Jackson Hole Mountain Resort or Grand Targhee or the backcountry and head over to Snow King Mountain Resort. Bob, why don't you give us kind of the backstory on Arbor Snowboards? And first of all, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, Mike. Yeah, we just finished up our 25th year in business, founded in late 1995, November 1995. I think to lay out what Arbor's all about, you got to kind of look at how Chris, the co-founder, and I grew up. We grew up at a time when the conversation about the environment was coming off the protest field and into the school system and into the world of media, Jacques Cousteau, Wild Kingdom, and just it was a conversation that the planet was in trouble and we needed to do something about it in school. Chris and I grew up surfing and skating together and I had started snowboarding in the late 80s. And I was living in Colorado. I had spent a year traveling, backpacking, budget traveling around Asia and the South Pacific. And I came home on my way back to Colorado and I ran into Chris and he hit me up about an idea, something he was starting to build, and it was about this business that was about selling sustainable wood from Hawaii into the world of forest products. So the world of lumber and wood products and construction materials and all the things you need, you know, the world around all the wood materials that that go into building things. I had these plans to get involved, get into real estate and just snowboard as much as I could. And I had no interest in staying in California, but the idea of doing something around sustainability, getting over to Hawaii to get the material that we were going to sell and surf and travel and build something that mattered was too interesting. And I basically dropped all my plans and we started our first company, which was called Coalition. And Coalition was a total failure. We got out there into this old school, old boy network world and started talking about sustainability. And people were like, sustain a what? And you want me to pay what for what? And what do you mean we should be thinking about the environment? And we faced a ton of rejection. And we learned a lot of really important lessons in that failure. We really learned that if you're going to offer something that's better for the environment, especially back then, and get people to embrace it, it better be a priced competitively with the non-sustainable materials, because you really only could get people to give it a shot if they weren't being asked to sacrifice and pay more for it. It better be as well designed, it better be as well made, the quality better be as good as what exists out there, because only then could you stand toe-to-toe with the big boys and talk about a sustainability story and you use it as a tiebreaker. You could, but everything else had to be on par. And, I always talk about, quality performance. There's a lot of environmental solutions out there, hemp being one of them. None of us are wearing a lot of hemp today. It's uncomfortable. It's, traditional linen-based hemp. It doesn't feel good next to the skin. We're not, because nobody's really willing to sacrifice comfort to make that switch. And that's what we learned when we were out there trying to sell this koa wood into the wood products world, which and focusing on sustainability. And We worked on it for a few years, and we learned those lessons. We ended up selling less raw material and more finished products. And we were going snowboarding every chance we could. And in that process, we started talking about making sustainable snowboards. On those trips from Venice, where we live, to Mammoth, we were talking about how, the Surfskate Snow World was not talking about sustainability. And it was kind of mystifying to us. The industry was so focused on that 14, 15, 16-year-old male with, a presentation that was very urban, not about urban art or, urban culture. It was, things that were very popular at the time, things that had a place in snowboarding. But there was, for us, going snowboarding, getting to the mountains was about getting away from the urban environment and, escaping to the mountains. And we didn't think anything reflect a love of the mountains and a respect that comes along with loving the mountains for the environment. And we talked about it for about a year. And finally, through a pretty funny process, we launched Arbor. And, in our first year, came out and talked about sustainability and the need to protect the planet and using alternative materials that are better, reduce our footprint, reduce the footprint of producing snowboards on the planet. A few years later, we added skateboards and apparel, and we were off and running. So that's the beginning in a nutshell.
Well, obviously, if you named the company Arbor from day one, you've had that environmental ethos. And, the first time I remember seeing Arbor boards, the top sheets just stood out. And it was, like you said, it was so different than, especially in the early 90s, everything we were seeing, and that market was really being geared toward the 14 to 16-year-olds. And all of a sudden you had this other company kind of coming out of left field. And then being from Southern California, that's where I'm from, but it was like, oh, a snowboard company in Cali. But the boards were so different. And it seems like now everybody, likes to talk about all the different woods, and sustainability is this new, big, kind of oxymoron in the ski and snowboard industry, but a lot of brands love to try and say they're doing it. And I think that you mentioned in the early 90s, if you were trying to sell a product that was going to be more expensive and your target audience was 14 to 16 years old, a $1,000 snowboard or something that was even a couple hundred dollars more, just because it looks nice, people wouldn't do that. And so now, all of a sudden, we see the Arbor stuff. And for the last, at least 20 years that I've been doing this, it seems like every year you really focused on that sustainability and that stewardship aspect. For anybody that doesn't know, what does the word Arbor mean?
Arbor is a Latin word for tree. And I think for us, obviously, forests are where we get our renewable, sustainable wood materials that we launched the brand with, with sustainable wood and bamboo top sheets and sustainable wood cores were the first things that we changed in the way we constructed our boards. We also were first to bring recycled metals and recycled plastics and bioplastics and more environmentally friendly finishes and waxes through the years. But we launched with wood, and wood was important for us to sort of get out there and not just have a change that we were talking about, but something people could see. The wood top sheet was so much different than the graphic, heavy graphic top sheets of the era, and loud, bright colors, strong messages. We came out with these clean wood tops, and each wood that we used had a story about sustainability, about the natural world, and a look that was different. And it was cool because every single board we made, because the nature of wood grain, was one of a kind. And we were able to get out there. We literally used the word sustainability in our first catalog in 1995, which I probably started putting together in 94. That was what we launched for. We launched Arbor to focus on, making snowboards that were sustainable and of a high quality, really high craft level of craftsmanship. Which, if you know about sustainability, a lot of it ties to durability and how long things last, and less disposable products. So things that are built to last, built to continue performing, don't end up in landfills, and you don't have to make new ones quickly. You can do better by the planet when you make products that last. So sustainability and craftsmanship were the two pillars with which we launched the brand on. But it wasn't easy. I will tell you that in the 90s, mid to late 90s, when we would talk about the environment and the need to protect it and the need for people who use the environment as a playground to be out in front of the discussion around sustainability. And at that point, it was mostly academics. Nobody, you know, in Surfskate Snow was talking about environmentalism. In the larger outdoor world, you had Yvonne Chouinard from Patagonia, but he was kind of a lone voice. And he's actually the first guy I ever gave a snowboard to as a way of just to say thank you and tell him how much I appreciated his inspiration. But when we jumped into snow and skate with a message about protecting the planet and environmental conservation and sustainability, people straight up laughed. People were like, that is so soft. I don't get it at all. And, you know, something that we saw so clearly as being important was not what core snowboarding got. And it was tough. We had a certain amount of pride and we believed in what we were doing. And we were focused on this message that was so outside of snowboarding. You know, we were just two kids that loved to snowboard. We hadn't come through the industry. We weren't reps. We hadn't worked in a shop. I hadn't gone and worked at another company. We were just guys that knew how to build things with a tradition of craftsmanship and manufacturing with wood and a years-long love of snowboarding. And that was it. So we weren't really tuned to sort of the endemic attitudes of the time. And that allowed us to get going, but we ran face long into a wall of sort of what was cool and what was not cool in snowboarding. I think, you know, there's still about five stores out there that really bought in and believed in what we were doing, or at least saw that it was different enough to give us a chance. And behind all of that was there was a customer that wanted it. And thankfully, that was just enough for us to get through a time where people did not get it. It's amazing, you know, the millennials, you know, Gen X was really not receptive, but when millennials came into the market and then now Gen Z, our message has been, you know, very, very resonant. But in the 90s, you know, our generation was hard and sort of exclusive and not open-minded to new ideas. And we had to battle through that. I think in the end, it made us a tougher, better company. And we're probably here because of the challenges that we had to push through. And we're definitely here because of that. But it was not accepted. And we had to find a way to work around that to get to our customer. And we also had to find a way to embrace it. And really, for us, that was reaching out to athletes and also artists and bringing people who were more endemic to snowboarding into our collective of people and broadening the who managed and ran and built the vision for the company while we focused and continue to focus it to this day on sustainability and craftsmanship.
And it would be really easy for you guys to kind of, you know, ride that story to the bank, but you're taking it a step farther. Now you have a forestry project going on in Hawaii. What's going on there?
So we've actually done that since day one. You know, we've thought a lot about how to be good stewards of the environment with give back. And we thought a lot about that with the previous business and had made give back commitments with Coalition. You know, with everything that we sold, we committed to planting a certain amount of trees. And as we launched Arbor and kind of looked at what we could do, could we work with a big national organization? Could we form a national organization? And had been doing it long enough to see that a lot of people were spinning their wheels. A lot of people were lobbying the government to change. A lot of people were, you know, working with big organizations and seeing very, very little actual tangible effect on the planet. So we just decided to start a program, which we call Returning Roots, and just go plant trees ourselves, you know, find local partners that could help us get trees in the ground. We kind of did an end run around the environmental industry at the time, and because we just wanted to actually see a positive change on the planet for our give back efforts. And we picked Hawaii for a couple of really specific reasons. Obviously, Hawaii is where mankind invented the concept of sliding sideways. The native Hawaiians 1,000 years ago, 800 to 1,000 years ago, depending on who you talk to. invented the sport of surfing. And that ancient sport led to the modern sport of surfing, which inspired the idea of sidewalk surfing, which is skateboarding today. And both of those inspired the idea of sort of surfing mountains, surfing snow. So everything that we do in the surf, skate, snow world really ties back to the native Hawaiians who created the idea that we could slide sideways and inspired all the fun that we have today. So we're not just putting roots back in the ground, we're giving back to the roots of the whole surf, skate, snow experience. So it's supporting the environment, it's supporting the place and the people that created the world of surfing, skating, and snowboarding. It's also, for us, it's a way of really restoring the whole biodiversity of a forest, not just planting trees. So many tree planting efforts are just planting softwoods in clear cuts that will be cut again in 60, 70 years. We are actually, we spend $60 a tree. We get into a piece of land, get the unindigenous plants and animals out. We put nutrients back into the soil. We put up fences to keep the unindigenous animals out. And then we start planting koa trees. And then we also plant all the other interim low-level, medium-level trees and plants, native plants, that help restore the whole environment, creating the kind of biodiversity that brings the bird life and the insect life back. And basically, we're planting a whole forest rather than just rows of trees. And then we put CCNRs on the land so that the deed restricts the land from ever being cut or harvested again. And it's a really, it's funny because it's not something that's easy to put on a tagline and make a one for one, or, you know, make into something that people can easily understand through a few words. It's a really complex effort to fully restore the full biodiversity of the original environment that existed in these koa forests that were all chopped down at one point to raise cattle. And it's about restoring those natural environments and in a way that will last and be there for generations to come. I always joke, but it's not a joke. I intend to camp in these forests with my grandchildren, fully restored koa forests, both on work we've done on Maui and on the Big Island of Hawaii. And that's called our Returning Roots Program. And it's something we've done since the day we launched the brand. Every year we've donated to planting, every year we've planted trees in Hawaii, and really, again, focused on putting those roots back in the ground and supporting the roots of the surf, skate, snow experience.
It's so rad because it's full circle. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh just recently passed away, you know, the Buddhist monk, and he talked about how everything's connected. And, you know, trees have the ability to make their own rain. And so here you are in, you know, the Pacific, and you're planting this, you know, beautiful forest. And not only is it going to help, you know, the native culture and the Hawaiians and all the people living there and the fauna and the, you know, all the animals, but those storms are going to now track across the Pacific. And then all of a sudden now Southern California is getting rain and Mount Baldy and Big Bear. And then that same storm's going to track across and hit Utah and then ideally Colorado, or maybe it goes up north. And so it's really amazing that you guys see that story. And a lot of other brands are trying to talk that story, but sustainability is a tough thing. And you mentioned, you know, Yvonne, he, you know, the time that we had spoken, I think in his book, his latest book, he says, you know, sustainability is an oxymoron. And the outdoor industry for many years has really done a good job of kind of greenwash. You know, hey, you know, this product's recycled, or it's made out of recycled bottles. I mean, Patagonia has completely walked away from saying, you know, our whole line is made of recycled stuff. And so we're really starting to figure out that it's easy to talk about this stuff, but to actually walk the walk. And then to be conscious of, you know, your supply chain, and you mentioned, you know, your metals and where your wood's coming from. Do you guys know how many trees Arbor has put in the ground at this point?
It's hard to say. I can tell you that our latest give back, we're part of an effort that has put over 550,000 trees in the ground. But how do I quantify that for you when we're also putting in ohia and sandalwood and other plant life that's just as critical as the tall, you know, obvious koa trees that we're putting in the ground, well over 1 million with this latest project. And that is just something we've been doing for the last 5 or 6 years. It's hard to say because we're not focused on the individual tree. So I can say to somebody, I planted a tree for every, you know, board you bought. We're not interested in that. We're interested in actually restoring the environment. You know, sustainability is an oxymoron if you let it be. You know, I always tell people recycled plastic is still plastic. Bioplastic is still plastic. The same chemistry we get out of plants, the same chemistry we get out of petroleum, is the chemistry we're getting out of modern plants. We're looking for the same chemicals to make plastics. The only difference between bioplastics and plastics made from petroleum are plants that are living today and plants that lived a million years ago. Well, so why is it better for the environment? Most people don't even understand that it's only about the carbon footprint savings that you get when you use a bioplastic over a traditional plastic. And the savings can be as much as 40 to 50% because you're not having to pull it out of the ground, transport around the world, refine it. You can pull it out of a local plant that's native to your local environment, and you can hence get that chemistry easier. But it is still the same difficult material that you're putting into the environment. And recycled plastic is great, but the human factor, I mean, there are plastics that you can recycle over and over and over again. It could be the perfect material if it wasn't for the fact that humans are screwing up that process. And, you know, I'm not a big anti-humanist. I think we are part of the environment. We need to be seen as part of the environment and look at ourselves as part of the environment. We don't need to be removed from the environment. You know, I always say that a chairlift is a pathway to being environmentalist. You get somebody inspired to go snowboarding, they're ultimately going to walk away with a passion for protecting the environment. But it's just true that we are not managing the plastics in our life and we're not recycling them. So it's become a very difficult problem to solve because of that, you know, the way that we deal with our waste. I don't necessarily have an answer. We've always tried to be really honest about where we are. We have a real progress, not perfection. Look at sustainability. About 80% of our processes and our products, our materials, are sustainable, and we're working on the other 20%. And we are not perfect, but we continue to aspire to be perfect. But we want to tell people that. We want to tell people that the bioplastics aren't perfect. We want to tell people that recycled plastics aren't perfect. You know, there's a whole movement to do these, for example, to do this biodegradable material. But if you look at the fine print, they're not biodegradable. They need to be brought back to a single place and submerged in a bath of chemicals so that you can break the components up and then they can be individually dealt with. Biodegradable to means that you can throw it in your backyard and inside the biosphere, it will degrade to its natural components. So many things that are being called biodegradable are not biodegradable. You look at a biodegradable plastic forks, read the fine print on the box. They have to be sent back. And once they're sent back, you're doubling the carbon footprints. When you have a reverse distribution model to try to bring something back to deal with it, well, you guess what? It's going to take as much fossil fuels to bring it back as it did to get it out there to the world. There's so much hypocrisy. And the only way to make it not hypocritical is to be honest and tell people what's good, what's bad. We're not there yet, but it's steps towards a better future, not, you know, the future. Not that we're doing things perfectly now. And it sucks because when we talk that way, like everything's great, and then people discover that it's not great, or worse, when we tell people that it's terrible and they discover that it's not as terrible, some particular part of the environment, we lose people. And they call us out as full of shit. And we lose people's passion for protecting the environment. So I think honesty and transparency is the only way to offset the potential for hypocrisy and in an effort around sustainability.
And I like that you're being completely open and honest about that. And I think that there's really only a few brands that do understand that. You know, you said 80%, you know, that 20% you're working toward, but you also know that that's still there. I had this talk, you know, again with Patagonia, and I said, well, why do you guys send everything to me? You know, I get it and it's in a box and then it's in a plastic bag within the box. I said, isn't that wasteful? And they said, well, when they tried to stop using plastic bags, because obviously, you know, how can we reduce our footprint? 30% of their stuff got returned as being damaged in shipment. And you had just mentioned, you know, the carbon footprint. You start sending stuff back and forth. One of the things I have on my website on the About Us page, right at the top, it says, don't buy what you don't need. And we, you know, I work in an industry where I'm trying to tell people, okay, this is the gear you got to buy. But it's also really, especially in ski and snowboard, it seems really wasteful where, like, if you work, if you live at a resort, it's like, well, you got to have a new jacket every year and you got to have a new board and, you know, and maybe a new split board. And it's like, wow, I just, like, I grew up surfing. I still have boards from the early 90s at my mom's house that still rip, you know, old Lost boards, old, you know, Chaz, all of it. And they're rad. And I just, I don't really see that in surfing. You know, like, I had a wetsuit for 15 years. I think now I've had my wetsuit for 4 or 5 years. And so somehow in the ski and snowboard industry, it's a little bit more wasteful, but now we are starting to hear people really, you know, talking about these environmental stories. If there was the ability to have a factory like SWS, obviously a very green, I think it's one of the most green, if not the first or second in the world. If there was an ability to have a factory like that in the United States, how much would that help cut down on the carbon footprint? Or is it not really a big deal to be getting wood from Hawaii and sending that wood to a factory that's across the world and then getting that wood sent back as a snowboard?
Yeah, that's really, again, there's that honesty thing. I've seen other companies really brag about their carbon footprint because of the location of their factory. And that's just bullshit. We, you know, the global brands are selling and shipping product to China and Japan, to Europe, to North America, to South America. This is a global business. It's a global sport. Same with skateboarding, same with surfing. The only way to reduce the carbon footprint from the shipping of our products around the world, other than offsetting it with the planting of hardwoods, and that's something we should talk about, you know, why hardwoods as opposed to softwoods. The only way to do it is to put factories in each market. You know, ideally, you have a factory in Europe, you have a factory in Asia, and you have a factory in the Americas, North America, preferably. And then you can do that. But the problem is economies of scale. We're just not a big enough industry to get the economies of scale that makes that doable. You know, even the biggest companies out there that have almost got there have pulled back on doing that kind of manufacturing. So it's tricky for an industry like, you know, winter sports or skating, surfing to do that. So the answer for me lies in the type of materials you use and how you offset that the carbon that you're burning to produce and ship your products. And for us, that's with the planting of trees and the Returning Roots program. But that's tricky too, you know, and like I said, you know, people plant softwoods or non-tropical hardwoods, and they don't realize that the carbon offset is only for the life of the tree. When a softwood dies in a forest, even if it's protected and not cut down, it's actually interesting. When you make something out of a wood product, you're locking up the carbon for the life of the product. So if you have an antique desk, that's carbon locked up for as long as the life of that product. But assuming that the tree is living a natural life and is not part of a farm, a tree farm, and where it's going to be made into a product, if that softwood dies, it rots, dry rots, even if it's in a wetter environment, it basically dry rots and releases its carbon back to the environment. And a few years ago, it's probably been 10 plus, the NRDC really identified this, that non-tropical hardwoods and softwoods release their carbon when the tree dies back in the form of gas. Only in tropical environments are the conditions so wet that a tree wet rots and basically mulches, and other plant life quickly grows over that mulching tree, sinks their roots into that tree that's turning into dirt and pulls the carbon out, re-sequestering it with each successive generation of plant life. So in a tropical hardwood environment, you can sequester carbon for the life of the forest. If, assuming the forest is healthy, that is the kind of carbon sequestration that we really need to focus on. And that's one of the other reasons why we picked Hawaii. It's the only place in the United States. Our Arbor is a company based in the U.S. So it's the only, it's our local effort. And so the only tropical hardwoods we have are the coforests of Hawaii. So it's really about knowing what you're doing before you open your mouth and you spout off about how sustainable your efforts are. Because you're just putting yourself out there and your brand out there for being called out eventually, for not understanding how things actually work. And when I see people really being truthful about it and really going for it, which requires that transparency, you know, which I'm seeing a lot these days, frankly, to be honest with you. I think we're going in a good direction.
Yeah, I agree. And it's got to be hard for, you know, brands that have talked that sustainability story to kind of, you know, walk backwards or heaven forbid somebody calls them out like you mentioned. What about Koa surfboards? Has that been something that Arbor has considered doing? Or have you guys made, you know, boards for yourselves? You know, the old, you know, Alihi, you know, Hawaiian style boards. Is that something that, is there a market for that? You know, especially with you guys being based in Southern California?
You know, we don't enter a market until we feel like we can provide change either in performance or sustainability. We have done collabs. We did for a couple of years a collab with Firewire that was a lot of fun. They launched with bamboo top sheets and we brought wood and koa wood and inlaid tops to what they were doing. And it was a hell of a lot of fun. Mark, the founder, is a guy who I personally think has a vision and wants to do things right. Surf's tough though. You know, Mickey Munoz once told me that, and he was right, that every single surfboard that's been shaped since the introduction of the foam core still exists because it's not biodegradable. And there's not been a good solution yet. I really do like what they're doing with the agave cores, but the source of supply is really tricky. And I think there's something there, but it has yet to be able to get up to the kind of scale that will actually limit the impact of producing surfboards on the market. Somebody's really got to solve that core issue. Agave is a good opportunity, and it's a way of working with the tequila industry, which uses a different part of the plant, but there's not enough, from what I gather, or there's not the pipeline to really make it work. That's what I know superficially. There could be more there than I know, but that's where Arbor would, you know, everybody in the company surfs, so it's something we'd love to get into. But it would require us finding an honest technology that we can be transparent about and, you know, getting into it in a way that's true to the brand. It'll happen one day, I think. In the meantime, we've got plenty to do in the world of skateboarding and snowboarding, and I can tell you that a lot of good thinking's happening in the lineup.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about gear. How long have you guys, or what was the reason to have a line of, for the most part, boards that I think most of the boards in your line have a rocker and a cambered version? Is that something that you guys have been doing? It seems like at least for the last 5 years or so, but what was the decision to do that and not just say, okay, the Arbor Koa is just a rockered board?
We don't believe in hybridization, straight up. We feel... A great metaphor for me is the enduro motorcycle. It's not perfect, but it, you know, if you ride street, you don't want to be on an enduro. You want to be on a street bike. It corners better. It's faster. The kind of handling that you need for serious street riding is what you'll end up on. If you ride dirt, you ultimately want to be on a dedicated dirt bike that's lighter, that has stripped down. It doesn't have all the things you need to be street legal. It's going to have the right kind of pop and ability to land, you know, jumps. And it's just a better product for somebody who's pursuing riding in the dirt. And when you squish street features with dirt features, you're going to get this hybrid that with, you know, this enduro motorcycle that doesn't do either great. And we kind of believe that both camber and rocker have a really important place in snowboarding. When you size somebody up for a board, you first talk about, you know, what's their skill level. And then you talk about where they want to ride, you know, what terrain do they want to ride. You'll talk about price, what can they afford. But ultimately, when you identify, you know, the price, their skill level, and their target terrain, it's how do you want to ride? Are you kind of looking to surf the mountain in a really organic line where you're slashing banks and you're really kind of in a more soulful way surfing the mountain? Or are you up on your edge and you're really, it's about speed and the performance provided by a really dedicated edge where you can build and maintain speed. You know, you've got that camber shape that provides that leaf spring pop and an ollie or out of a turn. And you're really pursuing steeper lines. So true camber, pure camber also has a great place. And when you start mixing camber and rocker for us, and this is just our philosophy, and you know, we don't want to say we're better than anybody else's philosophy, but this is ours. When you start mixing rocker and camber, you give up on all of the benefits of each. And it's also very confusing to the market where rocker and camber is, where flat spots are. It starts to, this bucket called hybrid snowboards is very difficult to explain to a customer when it can be, you know, 13, 14 different designs. You know, I think at last count, I think I counted 15 basic hybrid designs, whether it be camber, rocker, or any other variation in between. And it's very hard to help people understand why a hybrid works and why it would work for them. So we really talk about that fourth dimension of how are you going to attack that terrain, that target terrain? And are you more of a camber person or a rocker person? And today we kind of feel like it's just another dimension of a board, your length, your width, your flex, and your riding profile. So we will offer the Coda, for example, in different lengths, different widths, and both rocker and camber, so that our customers, when the end user comes in, can really get them on the right board for all of the things that come together in their snowboarding. And the thing that makes that possible for us is the system. We have a two-part simple technology that we call the system, where we bring together, to explain it quickly, an unblended side cut, where we, instead of blending where the multiple radiuses come together in a progressive or a parabolic side cut, we unblend it and we create two new contact points, heel and toe, that change how you communicate with the snow. And having those grip tech contact points in front of your toes or behind your heels, it speeds up and directly connects you in a very ergonomic way with the snow right under your feet. Instead of having to engage and disengage contact points that are out at the end of your snowboard, they're right underneath you, and you can put all your muscle and your mass into that. And it allows us to do a couple of very cool things. It really improves the contact and communication with the snow. So it allows us to make a pure rocker board that holds an amazing edge. So at speed, in bigger landings and steeper lines, our rocker shapes hold an incredible edge because of the way we build our side cuts and add contact points underneath your feet. And then when you load the board at higher speeds and steeper steeps, bigger landings, the outside contact points kick in, and you have four places that the board is really holding on to the snow and connecting that whole effective edge in a rocker board. But yet we haven't sacrificed any of the loose, fun, surfy performance that is so great for easy turning and spins and just that surfy vibe. We haven't sacrificed any of that. Then in our camber boards, we can, instead of doing these traditional radial camber, we always use a parabolic shape in our rocker and camber. It allows for lower rocker, so those outside contact points kick in sooner. But in our camber boards, we do a parabolic camber that's lower to the snow and doesn't have to have such dramatic sort of arc for those outside contact points that connect with the snow, which makes a board very catchy and very catchy, very hooky, very overly grabby. And with parabolic camber, we can flatten and clean out the board so that it's not so aggressive in its leading edge, because you've got grip tech under heel and toe. So you can de-emphasize those outside contact points and make a cleaner riding, smoother riding camber board that's not so catchy and hooky and overly grabby, yet not sacrifice any of the performance of riding true camber, any of the pop and the power and the very effective, very aggressive, effective edge. All those things that you want with a true camber board, we don't lose any of that through hybridization, yet we've made a cleaner riding camber board through, again, this combination of grip tech and parabolic shaping.
It reminds me of, you know, like when a brand comes out with a multi-tool and it's like, well, this can be a fire starter and a shovel and a flashlight. Well, it's not going to perform as well as just a dedicated flashlight or a dedicated fire starter. And so, like, I think you guys saw that and it's like, look, there is different styles of riders out there. And you've got somebody that really wants that light, surfy feel, and they get on the Coda and the rocker version, and they're just kind of floating, and they can, you know, ride really, really light. That's typically how I like to ride, but I also ride camber. And so, you know, with that, it's nice to kind of have that edge hold and have that pop and be able to really kind of load the board up and then to trust the edge. We go back and forth. I mean, we get, you know, rocker boards and cambered boards, and when they don't have as much of a blend, that's when it's truly the best. Because like you said, especially with the split boards, that's what we ran into, is a lot of brands were doing these just really crazy profiles. And I've probably beat this as a dead horse on this profile or on this podcast, but you know, we had these really wavy, you know, bottoms, and it would go rocker camber to rocker, you know, hybrid. And then obviously on the skin track, that's points of contact that it's going to make it harder for the board. And then as Jeremy Jones and I talked about, I said, you know, I have a feeling when you're putting skins onto a board like that, it's making it a lot harder for that skin to stick to the board, because now there's, you know, if you think about it in theory, there's these little up and downs as opposed to like the skin being taut to the end and the other end and just having a nice kind of a plain, even surface, you know, whether that's a rocker or whether that's a camber. And so to have this, I mean, it's great. It really shows that, you know, and everybody's very specific. I mean, I remember a couple of years ago, I saw a Gooch and I said, oh, you know, I'm on this Coda rocker split board and I really love it. And he said, oh, you got to be on the camber one. I was like, okay. And then I tried the camber one. I was like, holy shit, this is really good. I mean, I liked both of them, but definitely for a different type of rider, you know, if I'm splitboarding and I'm going to be out there for a whole day, or if I'm guiding, or if I'm going to be putting the skin track in, I definitely want to go, you know, an Arbor, you know, cambered splitboard as opposed to the rocker. Rocker's a little bit more fun, but, you know, on the skin track, it definitely can have their issues. But I think you guys saw this, and for the splitboard specifically, I thought I remember a few years back, you guys kind of adjusted that profile just a little bit. Am I right on that?
Yeah, so our parabolic shape is five circles, so along the running surface. So, you know, five rocker shapes or five camber shapes. But the amount of tunability that we have in our boards by having a blended five radii parabolic shape, either in our rocker and our camber, is amazing. And with our rockered split boards, we lowered the board in the back so that you have more skin contact from your front foot all the way to the tail of your board, which improves the skin track performance. Gooch is right. You know, you're going to sacrifice a little bit of your up performance to be able to have a rocker in that pure pow line that you're going after. If you're up and you're down, have some mixed conditions, some wind blown, some crust, that camber board is going to feel a lot more confident. Is it going to give you more confidence in those mixed conditions? But there's nothing like being on a rocker board on that day where you're riding nothing but powder. It just is oriented to the snow dynamics like a boat's hull or a surfboard is, which is rockered in fluid dynamics. And it just wants to, with every turn, move up out of the snow because of the way the edge and the riding surface are oriented. So again, there's people who don't want to sacrifice that rocker performance in the pow and will deal with a little bit less on-skin performance, and they'll ride our rocker splits. And there are people who want the mixed condition performance of riding performance and want the better on-skin performance, and they'll ride our camber boards. But for us, that's how we see it. We see these as two pure technologies, pure rocker and pure camber, and they each have a viable place in the market. And we've just made the decision not to play in the other bucket, into the hybrid bucket world, because, again, it's confusing. There's no way of explaining it to a customer because of how many different types of hybrid designs are out there. And it's arguable. The performance, for me, is always arguable. And whether you're talking about skins or just on snow. So, you know, we've just decided to, I think we're kind of purists at heart. And we just have decided that hybridization has no place in any of our snowboard line.
I like that. And I know that a lot of the other brands listening to this podcast, and so hopefully some of the designers and reps and the people I've been kind of hammering this home to hear what you're saying. And obviously you don't just take any board in the line and cut it in half and make it into a split board. Not every board should be a split board. And, you know, the stuff that you guys have, I mean, it's, you got the Gooch, the Coda, a couple women's boards. Is there a third split?
We're doing MFRs as split. The Coda and the Swoon are split. That's our rocker offering. And then we have Gooch's pro model is split. His new Satori, which is coming out next year, is split. MFR's Veda is split. And then we have a new price point split, which I'm really excited about. One of the great questions that I have been asked is, why are split boards so much more expensive? And, you know, is it directly related to the cost of construction? And I don't think we've been able to always justify that. And for us, if we care about split boarding from an industry standpoint, and we want, you know, and this is people have mixed feelings about this. Certainly COVID didn't help. But if we want people to be able to experience the backcountry, hopefully safely, with the right kind of training and with going out with the right people. In 26 years of doing this, I've never not known somebody who knew either directly or somebody who was at least removed by no more than one degree who died in the backcountry. So you know, I can't say enough about backcountry safety and the need to get your training, but we still want people to be able to access it. We can't be a sport for the elites, for the one percenters, the two percenters. And splitboarding is so hard, it's so unapproachable to gear up because of the cost. We should probably also talk about the value of used gear to the world and to our sport and to our culture. But we've come out with a board that's probably, we believe, is the most affordable splitboard on the market, because we believe that we have a responsibility to the larger community to make snowboarding less expensive. And, you know, we could get into diversity. We could get into what is it going to take to make these winter sports more accessible to different socioeconomic classes. But certainly on our part, we want to be part of the effort to make at least the gear affordable when we can. And so we have a new price point split that we're very proud of.
I like that. And I like that you talked used gear. We'll kind of get into that. As far as, you know, most of the stuff right now in the outdoor industry that I'm seeing, you know, the prices continue to go up. We're testing e-bikes and some other stuff, and that stuff, the price is continuing to come down, you know, the foil surfboard. So it's really interesting. I mean, we have solid boards that we test that cost more than some of the split boards that we test. And then when we do our roundup of how is that possible? Exactly. And then how do I justify that to the consumer, or how does the person in the shop, well, this is this, but you know, or here's this split board, it's $1,200. And by the way, it doesn't even come with skins. That, you know,
it's not going to last forever.
It's not going to last forever.
It's not going to last forever because of just the natural evolution of competition. And I hate to say let's hope it's not a race to the bottom, because we got to preserve quality and performance. And when it comes to anything in the backcountry with a real part of the sales pitch has to be around training and backcountry safety, but it can't last. It can't last at the price points that it is without people coming in and trying to right-size the pricing. And frankly, if that bothers anybody, I can't say enough about participation. We need to bring people to snowboarding. We need to make snowboarding affordable and accessible and welcoming. And right now, some of the prices make people feel like it's not the sport for them. And if we're talking about diversity in our companies, we better start thinking about the prices that we're offering things to the community for. And so I feel good about it. And I'm proud that Arbor, not just in splitboards, but for years, for me, I rant about sustainability. You know, you cannot pursue the whole foods, the whole paycheck model. You cannot save this planet with rich people alone. You can't save it with college graduates alone. You can't save it with urban dwellers alone. You have to make your products available to all socioeconomic classes. Only together, every price point, can we lessen the impact that producing snowboards has on the planet. So price, you know, for years, we made a board for $299. That board's now up a bit because of all the inflation that we're all seeing at all levels. But we still make an incredibly affordable snowboard.
Are you talking about the foundation? That board rips. The board rips, and it's so cheap.
It's got all of our grip tech and parabolic shaping. It's got our same warranty. It's made in the Dubai factory with 100% solar power. But by stripping it down, we've been able to bring that price point to a different customer and allow that person to participate in an effort around sustainability. Every single customer that we have at every socioeconomic level, whether they know it or not, is participating in our efforts to reduce the impact that producing Arbor snowboards has on the planet. And any other effort, if just your expensive boards are your green boards, then you're faking it. I'm sorry. You're
100%.
Faking it, because we cannot save this planet with rich people alone. And I get on my high horse about that one, and maybe I shouldn't, but it's something I believe in, And that's something we're taking to splitboarding.
No, I like it. And it shows that you guys are actual participants as well. And you've got a good pulse of the culture. I mean, last night I was just having a talk with Mike Rankwit, and you know, it seems like the snowboard industry is completely out of touch with who they're even marketing to. You know, you've got Pat Bridges, he's been the editor of Snowboard Magazine for 20 plus years. And it's like, well, that was a time when we were marketing to 14 to 16 year olds, like you said, in the early 90s. Like, who's the consumer right now? Most of the people on my website, they're in their 40s or 50s, and they're working a desk job, and they're, you know, it's, how do we get this next group of snowboarders? I mean, all my friends that have kids, they're starting them on skis, and you know, that's, I don't know that kid's going to make the skiing's kind of cool now. And so I don't know that those kids make that transition back to snowboarding. And if we're just saying, I mean, God, there's a guy here in town that's making, you know, wooden boards or custom boards, and they're $1,500. And I'm just like, whoa, dude, like, that's a piece of art. Like, I don't think somebody should buy that and snowboard. And then if people think that that's what you need, I'm kind of sensitive even on the whole quiver thing, you know, like, give me one board that I can ride top to bottom. I think the Coda is one of those boards. I mean, even the Coda split board, you could ride that inbounds and still have fun. But to think that you need 10 boards, you know, surfing, I had a couple boards. I had a short board and I had like a gun, but it wasn't like I was going to buy every, you know, all these different things. And I think the surf industry knew that, and they weren't trying to sell me a new snowboard or a new surfboard every year. I mean, it'd be kind of comical.
We live in the bubble just like everybody else. And the whole quiver concept does not take into consideration that your average snowboarder gets 5 or 6 days a year.
Right.
So that's the big, huge majority of the customer base. They're not going to quiver up. And then you've got a barrier to entry that is with price to have an effective modern quiver. People can't afford to have, you know, three setups, and it's just not reality. So we work very hard to make boards that have a range of function across a wide range of target terrain. And the Coda is a great example. You know, that's a you know, intermediate to advanced inbound, side country, and backcountry board. I mean, the board can attack powder. It's a mountain twin. It's you can ride it switch if you want in the park. It is such an all around great tool, high performance tool for snowboarding. You know, is it your best board in the park? No, but it is a great board for resort, side country, and some basic backcountry. And that just is an acknowledgement of the economic times we live in, and the bandwidth times that we live in, and the, you know, frankly, the just the reality of today's snowboarder. We talk to ourselves, though, and sure, our friends in the industry like to have lots of boards and try lots of boards, so why wouldn't everybody? It's just not a reality. But that's part of the insulated nature of our industry. And it is what it is. I mean, I'll be honest with you. Arbor focuses on 19 to, you know, we used to say 19 to 49. We wanted to be a brand that when you kind of stop, you know, when that young male kid stopped following the pack and buying what his friends thought were cool and started deciding what he or she really thinks of, you know, as a reflection of their values. We wanted to have them from that point for the rest of their life. And that sort of lifer snowboarder, you can say adult snowboarder or that lifer, is our customer. And it was the only company that really came out and said, there's a huge market here. Snowboarding's now, you know, effectively, you can effectively going on 50 years old as an industry. They're third generation, there's families of three generations of snowboarders. And there's this massive market out there of people who are doing it, they're going to do it till the day they die. And they need good quality gear that's built right, that's designed right, that's high, gives them the performance they need at the price they can afford. And I think the only company that's come out that's really acknowledged that is Jones. And I told Jeremy a couple of years back that he's made us a better company. Competition is so good. And he did. He came out, he recognized that there was a huge silent majority of customers out there that are core snowboarders. if you're dedicated to snowboarding and it's your life and it's part of your identity and you dream about it in the summer and you can't wait for that storm to come through, or just even a day of going and riding the groomers, you're as core as shit. And you don't have to be 15 to be that. I'm 53 years old now. I think more about snowboarding today than I did when I was, when I was in my early 20s. I'm just it's gotten so much deeper into my DNA and into my soul. I can't ever imagine not riding. And there's a lot of people out there that are in, their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and even 70s that are incredibly dedicated to snowboarding. And I don't want to give away our market, but I think we got to be thinking about the broader and wider customer base and their needs. We certainly try to do that at Arbor, and it's sort of one of the things we were founded to do.
Well, Bob, I really appreciate the chat. You guys, as you mentioned, you're making tools and you're making these fun boards. It's funny, we talked about the price point board because I remember getting it a few years ago, and I think Sean and even Dave were like, oh, we don't know if we want to send you this, it's not. And it ripped and it was so good. And then Rossignol did the same thing with one of their boards. And so there's a snowboard out there for everybody. It might not be that you need a quiver, but last but not least, how has having a brand being based in Southern California, Venice per se, at what point did the industry kind of embrace that? Because I remember for a while when I was in Colorado, you heard of Arbor, maybe you saw the top sheets, but outside of like Wave Rave or going to Mammoth, like there just wasn't, I wasn't hearing the buzz. I don't think I was really seeing them at Snow Summit.
When I started Arbor, Southern California was the largest regional market for snowboarding in the U.S. And it has something to do with just the people here are raised around surfing and skateboarding, and snowboarding is a natural. There were more shops here at one time than there are now, but Snowboarder and Transworld were based here in Southern California. And even in Venice alone, when I started, there was Family Snowboards and there was Hazmat. So Southern California has a really deep and rich tradition around board sports and snowboarding. It's changed a lot. The mags have gone away. A lot of the shops have gone away. A lot, Bridges just moved his new magazine up to Tahoe. But I can tell you that that snowboarding in Southern California is deeply valued and pursued at a very high level. For us, we the opportunity to snowboard early and late is important. Mammoth is usually one of the first mountains open, and it usually on any given year doesn't close till the 4th of July. So the amount of time to ride here in Southern California is serious. And it's been important for our brand. I also think that if we were in a mountain town, and obviously we spend, half my team is in Jackson Hole right now. But we spend a lot of time in mountain towns, in mountain environments. It's our home away from home, a number of places. But the customer lives in cities away from the mountains. They have to. They're in Denver. They're in Portland. They're in Seattle. And they're in L.A. They're in San Diego. They're in the places where they can work and live. And not everybody gets to live in a mountain town. And so understanding what it takes to be a snowboarder and the journey that's involved to get to the mountains, and for a lot of people, the journey becomes part of the experience. Getting in your car, packing up your gear, making sure that drive is enjoyable as it can be. For us, the journey from Venice to Mammoth and back was where we first started talking about Arbor. The journey from today, for me with my kids, the journey to Mammoth and back is, We stop at our favorite smokehouse. We stop and go to the hot springs. We stop and go on hikes. We stop and there's roads up there that we love to skate. There's endless turns. It is part of a larger life pursuing snowboarding. Surfing has understood that forever. The surf trip is part of the culture, is part of the experience. And the snowboard trip for those people who have to travel to snowboard pushes it deeper into your life. And as you get better at it, you make the journey part of the whole experience. And it's helped us understand our customer better. It's helped us be a better brand. And the fact that we can skate year-round and surf year-round is also a big part of our wider culture and our wider sort of life in surf, skate, and snow. So I love being in Venice. Venice has been great for us. Venice is not a beach town. It's a place of sort of culture, diversity, and design. And this is where Carroll Shelby did all his work on his cars. This is where the Eames family invented plywood, which ultimately led to the first kicktail skateboards or bent modern skateboards. So much happens in Venice that's inspiring from an art level, from a design level, from an environmental level. Venice, California has been a great place for Arbor to kind of explore all the things that make us who we are. So
we're pretty dedicated to it. You guys have done a great job of kind of expanding out of the California market, especially right now in Jackson, getting Gooch and the people that you have. I mean, mostly when I go out in the mountains now, I see people on Arbor splitboards, and that, if I'm in Colorado, you see a lot more Never Summer. If I'm up in the Northwest, you see the Libtex. And so it's really cool. Do you think California, like if you go up to Mammoth or Snow Summit, do you see a good chunk of Arbor? I just haven't ridden out west in so long. Do you see a good chunk of Arbor boards at the local mountains as well?
Yeah, we're where we want to be after 26 years. I'm proud to be there. We're very proud to be part of the wide world of snowboarding, wherever we are. I think we're the saturation that we're seeing for Arbor reflects the work we've done over all the years. I'm just happy to be at the table with brands like Lib and Never Summer, and even Burton and Jones, all good people, all working hard around something that they love and that we love. And we need each other, you know. A healthy industry acknowledges that we need each other, and we need each other to be strong and creative and working hard to make this industry great. You know, Arbor over the years has become less centralized. We have the collective is in hopefully an upside down pyramid. I'm at the bottom, just reminding people that it better be sustainable and it better be about craftsmanship. But everything else, that I leave it up to our athletes, our artists, our young managers to color in the lines and keep it fresh. And that's happening today, here in Venice and then all the little hubs that we have around the country and at this point around the world. So it's pretty rewarding, I'll be honest with you.
Well, right on, Bob. I'm stoked to have had you on the podcast. I will definitely hit your guys up about, hit Dave up about getting one of the new splits to try out. And thanks for really walking the walk. And it seems like, you kind of had this mindset from day one when you went from, Coalition to Arbor, and just it's authentic, and it really has that Patagonia feel. It would be really hard for a brand to just come out today and say, oh, we want to do, sustainability or we're going to make this product because we want to make a shit ton of money. And it's like, the girl that, the whole Terrier thing, the girl, she ended up quitting Burton because she wasn't making enough money working for Burton. And I'm like, I don't know if that's really the type of people you need in snowboarding. Cause it's, we're doing it out of a passion. And, obviously that really comes through with your board. So congratulations on 25 years. Stoked to see what you guys do for the next 25. And we'll have to have you on again sometime.
Thanks, brother. I'll tell you, when you start a company, you better believe in something. You got to believe in something with everything you got. Because for us, there was a point in snowboarding where we didn't fit. And if we didn't believe that we were doing something that mattered and needed to be part of snowboarding, there's no way we would have had the sort of fortitude, the grit to stick in there and hold it together and do it because we cared. And even if what was endemic in snowboarding at that time, thought it was soft and not right. We just decided we're going to keep doing it because we believe in it. And we were lucky enough that I don't know if we want to say we were right, but we were lucky enough that we saw that sustainability would eventually matter deeply to snowboarding, and it did, and it does today. And we only could have stuck to our guns by actually really identifying them in the beginning and fighting for them. And it's not easy, but it's worth doing if you're gonna start something. It's worth believing in something and sticking to that, because that's one of the only ways I think you can build a brand and get through the trying times, is stick to your beliefs, whether, you know, whether they're valued or not, when you launch. So I appreciate you seeing that, man.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob. I mean, again, thanks for keeping it real. And, that's going to be a tough question for a lot of brands in the future when somebody emails and just says, hey, like, where's the supply chain? Where's the wood come from? And I think you guys saw that. You're kind of out ahead of that. Obviously, you've got the messages on your website, and you've got all these great videos. And for any of the consumers out there, if you have not ridden an Arbor board, you know, we didn't talk about it, but I think there is something also to be said about riding wood. It's very lively. Not only are the boards, you know, can they be surfy, but you just feel a little bit different connection there versus something that's maybe more synthetic. So keep it up, Bob. Stoked on everything you guys have been doing.
Thanks, brother. Appreciate it.
Right on.
Have a great rest of your season.
All right. You too. Bye. All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of the Everything Snowboarding and More podcast. Thanks again to Bob Carlson for coming on. Make sure you check out his snowboards, his skateboards. We didn't even talk about it, but they're also making bindings. They've got some apparel. And yeah, you know, their snowboard line is solid. It has been for quite some time. And truly, you can see that Bob and his team, they're surfers, they're skateboarders, and snowboarders, of course. So thanks again for tuning in to episode 47 of the Everything Snowboarding and More podcast. And this episode was being sponsored by Snow King Mountain Resort.